I'm visiting here with Jay Kriss, director for a documentary called Harvesting the High Plains. And first of all, Jay, for people that don't know you, tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do.
Well, I'm a co-owner of a small little production company called Inspire Creative, and we're based in Williamsburg, Virginia. I've been in the film industry for going on about 30 years. Started back a little over 30 years ago working in ski films out west in Colorado, and then moved up through a lot of different aspects of film and television world, and a lot of different things from feature films to NFL films and all. I'm originally from Western Kansas. That's where I was born, and actually was started was grew up in a wheat farming family, and that's pretty much what my family does.
Well, and that's the subject essentially of the documentary that you produced. And why don't we move along there? It's called Harvesting the High Plains, and I know that it, having had a chance to see a copy of it myself, gives us a real good look at this thing that we know today is the wheat harvest and how that moves up. South to north during the harvesting season, but that all got started way back when, I guess.
Well, it did. It's, at the turn of the century, it's important, I guess, to understand historically that the Great Plains, that area that sits in the middle of the United States between the Missouri-Mississippi River there around Kansas City and Omaha, and the Rocky Mountains there at Denver, that area was initially called the Great Basin, or when Lewis and Clark and Thomas Jefferson was president and all the exploration was called the Great American Desert. Mark Twain once referred to it as a sea of grass without a drop of water to drink. And it was crossed as the gold rush times came on, but nobody ever really saw it as a habitable place for anybody to want to live. And around the turn of the century, what became apparent was that you could plant other sorts of grasses in that buffalo grass that was there. And wheat is a grass, as so many other grains are grasses. And they found that they could do that, and so around the turn of the century, we refer to it as the Great Plow Up occurred, and all of a sudden, the land that was raising cattle and buffalo and other hoofed beasts now was plowed up, and we think we remember back to some of the wars, the sod buster wars of the ranchers versus the sod busters that occurred out there. And of course, around the turn of the century, we also saw the big land rush that the government wanted people to come into that area, and the Homestead Act occurred. So there was an opportunity to try and get people to live there. And so we had this great plow up and great wheat harvests during those early 1900s. And it was around the early in the mid 20s that it started to become apparent there were some challenges with the agriculture style that was being used. It was plow up and plant, plow up and plant, in an area that got literally around 15 inches of rain a year. I mean, it's borderline a desert for all intents and purposes based on the amount of moisture. And there came a point where the drought set in the late 20s, early 30s. And then, of course, we know the story of the wind that started to blow in 33 and what became a period of time in our nation is known as the Dust Bowl, when so many farmers that had come there thinking they would find their riches decided to leave and head out west, which were out to California, which left just a few, a very few hardy individuals who thought they would try to find a way to partner with the land because the land was good land and they wanted to try and see if they could make it work. And that was where the process of summer fallow came in and really kind of where our story begins.
Well, it does start there, and very much an interesting story with some great imagery that you developed. Follow that story just a little bit to tell us, how you essentially follow what these two individuals in particular, farmers, did essentially to make a go of it there during a very tough time.
Well, the farmer, the group, the farm that we follow is a farm called GK Farms. And the object, what one of the partners in this farm operation really, he owned a lot of land. And he had sharecroppers farm, and he wanted to take it in and try to farm it the summer fallow means. But the gentleman lived in Wichita, Kansas, which is in southeast central Kansas. It's a good, well, today it'd take you 5 hours to drive there from western Kansas. So you can imagine the time it would take you to get there back in the 30s. But he hired a guy that was out there to kind of start running these farms for him. And they literally, of course, telephone was a massive luxury at that time. Most people didn't even have it, and there wasn't even service in most places. So they wrote letters, and they pretty much had what was really daily letter service. They could get a letter back and forth to each other in a day based on the trains. And so they literally wrote letters like we write emails today, and we had over a period of 14 years that we followed this farming operation, roughly about 10,000 letters that these guys wrote back and forth between each other and with bankers and others about what they were doing. And that gave us a real good look at what they had to do and how they had to do it. And you can imagine, I mean, we really had a conversation. We just didn't have the occasional letter. We had a conversation about every step they took.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that came across in terms of telling this story very well, I think. I'm curious, what it is that prompted you to want to do this, and how did you get started, essentially?
Well, there's a number of books that are written on Kansas agriculture history, and one of the authors is a gentleman by the name of Craig Miner. And Craig is a former history professor and chair at the Wichita State University, and sadly, Craig passed away in 2010. Craig came to us. He had written a book called The Business of Wheat Farming, Harvesting the High Plains, the Business of Wheat Farming. And I have an intimate knowledge of the story, and I'll share that more in a minute. But Craig had come to us and said, look, Jay, I know you're in the industry. I know you do this kind of work. I really feel that this would be a great documentary film. And the challenge that my partner and I have in creating documentary films is that you so often, particularly in historical documentary films, you run into a challenge that you have a lot of professors and people like that trying to interpret what happened rather than people telling you what happened. And in our case, we actually had these letters, so we had a dialogue. And so Craig opened the door to these letters to us. We didn't even know they existed. And that then opened up the story that opened up for us. We went to public television because we felt that we do a lot of work with public television. So we went to the Wichita station there, KPTS, and discussed with them the idea. They thought it was a great idea. And so they jumped on board. And so we started raising money for the film. So we raised money as a nonprofit through the film, a lot of support through foundations, a lot of agricultural companies came on board to support the film because they saw the real benefit in telling the story of how America's breadbasket came to be. And so that's how we got the process. So we finished our script in Topeka, which is where the archives were, and we started filming. And, of course, we filmed we had some modern footage that we shot just to get a feel for it, but then we also filmed out in western Kansas. We utilized a very great library at the National Archives of historic footage that was filmed back in the 30s and 40s that's in the archives at the National Archives. And there we were able to take the original film make a copy of it, and then digitize that for digital use today. And then, of course, we were out and we filmed a lot of our own establishing shots out west. Probably one of the more fun things that we did was we made a decision and the budget allowed us to do some reenactment work. And that allowed us to really take the film to what I think gave the emotion into the film, which was taking the town of Colby, Kansas back to the 1930s, to the dirty 30s, with 36 vintage vehicles that we brought in from that time, 70 people in vintage costume, becoming townspeople. And then, of course, we went up to Gearing, Nebraska, where the Farm and Ranch Museum in Gearing, which I can't say enough about. If you're interested in agriculture history, you just have to go. This is the Smithsonian of Agriculture, in my opinion. It's an amazing museum. And these people basically gave us the keys to the collection. Let us take this just incredible collection of equipment that was specifically used in this farming operation based on the letters that we had. And we got to put them on trucks and take it out in the dirt and actually farm with it. And that really was amazing. Really gave an opportunity to really show how hard it was to do what these guys did.
Well, you mentioned a personal connection to the project. Tell us about that.
Well, I said earlier on that I'm from Western Kansas, and I was born in Western Kansas in Colby, Kansas, which is 62 miles from the Kansas Colorado border. And the two men that started GK Farms back in 1933, one was named Ray Garvey. He was originally from Colby area, but lived in Wichita. And the other gentleman was John Chris, and that would be my grandfather. So I actually I still farm wheat. I'm actually a wheat farmer still. J. Chris Farms, which is my father's operation, we actually still farm wheat in Western Kansas. So I'm intimate with the farming industry still to this day. And I actually drove tractors on a lot of this land. So I'm very intimate with the story. It was a side of the story I never really thought about. And admittedly, it was a challenge for both Sydney and I to do the film because none of my family nor the Garvey family got to see anything about the film until they actually were in a theater watching the premiere. They never saw the film, never saw a cut, did not see the script. They didn't see anything until they were actually in the theater watching the film.
Wow. Well, that had to be a special moment.
I think everybody enjoyed it. I think there's a lot of trepidation. I don't think there was any ease around it for anybody because you're telling a story that obviously is very important to all these people. But, you know, it's a story that there's been three books written about. You know, these guys, this was not just a small farming operation. These guys were groundbreaking in what they did. You know, to think about in 1947, which is the last harvest that we follow, to literally have over 100,000 acres of ground in wheat that year, with another 100,000 in fallow. So, you know, a farming operation that had almost 200,000 acres in 1947 in operation in western Kansas and eastern Colorado. I always marvel, and I've got a copy of the telegram that was sent on July 3rd of 1947 to Garvey in Wichita, because they were coordinating their entire harvest by telegraph. Garvey was said to have literally brought a cot to the Western Union Station in Wichita and stayed there for almost a month back and forth with telegrams trying to move harvesters around. But on this one telegram, just for John to tell Garvey that he has 130 custom harvesters, custom combines, cutting in the fields that day. I think anybody today that has anything to do with custom harvesting has got to sit back and say, gosh, it's hard to keep track of three machines, much less 130 of them.
You mentioned the dirty 30s there, and it made me think of the fact that you have a narration throughout this. By Mike Rowe, who is Discovery Channel's Dirty Jobs guy.
That's right. Yeah, Mike did our narration for us, and Mike was our narrator, and Dirty Jobs, which it is kind of funny. It's Mike took a special interest in the film, and it was really fun to work with Mike because Mike actually started Dirty Jobs and did that as a testament to his grandfather, who had done just so many different jobs to make things work. And so Mike kind of, Dirty Jobs came out of a thing about his grandfather, and here this film had a leaning with around my grandfather, which mm-hmm. was kind of neat.
Yeah. Well, tell us about where you're at in this whole process and things like a distribution, if others would like to see the documentary.
Sure. The film is right now, actually, it'll be on, I don't know when we're going to air, but it's slated for a mid-March. It's airing mid-March prime time in New Mexico Public Television. It is aired in Kansas Public Television. It is going to be on in Nebraska and other stations in Kansas and Colorado in the very near future. We are actually in what we refer to as kind of our initial release. And what will happen from this point forward right now is we're actually now, we have just signed our agreement where PBS is going to be distributing our film for us through their distribution, digital distribution, and DVD distribution channels. That will be available this fall. So you can actually order it this fall through PBS. It'll also then start airing. We will have our national air availability this fall as well. So all that will roll out early fall, late August, early September. You can get an initial release of the film right now at our website, which is harvestingthehighplains.com, all spelled out, and you can order a copy of the film there. What's happening in addition to the film right now is that we have there's an educational component to the film that is going to be used for schools, and that is done through the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Foundation for Agriculture in the Classroom, and a number of states have worked up a curriculum around that, and that will be available to educators coming this fall as well through the PBS website. So this film will actually have an education point to it that'll be there. Mm-hmm. And with that, we are working with some of the student farm organizations as well in that rollout to have that available to educators as well.
Wow. So we will direct people there, of course, link them to the website, and they can, you know, maybe go ahead and get a copy to watch now if they'd like to see this, because I didn't know what to expect, but I found it very fascinating. And anybody that has a real interest in where our food comes from, and especially from a historical perspective, this gives them a great look into that.
Well, I think what's neat is that we've always heard of the Great American Breadbasket. And I mean, that's what really gets raised in the Great Basin and in the Great Plains. And that breadbasket saw a revolution. And that revolution occurred as the Dust Bowl descended, because this was when these guys really started to learn how to partner with the land. I always joke about the fact that we always hear today this whole idea of environmental activists and everybody that's all environmental this and farmers are terrible. I don't know how many times I hear that. And the reality is if you want to really find an environmentalist, you're going to find one in a farmer, because his greatest asset is the ground. So I always kind of sit back and say, you can have all the environmental activists you want, but I want an active environmentalist. And that's what a farmer really is. He's an active environmentalist. Mm-hmm. And that's what this film really, really celebrates. There is a back-end piece, the DVD, the new one that will come out this fall and release with the PBS. We'll have some extras on it. There'll be an interview with my producer and the co-writer on the film, City of All, my partner. She will both be interviewed in that piece. There's also going to be some extended interviews with some of the people that we interviewed in the film. And then there's actually a modern piece of the film that we talk about where wheat is today. The importance that wheat plays economically, the real economic impact that wheat has on the nation as a whole. I always joke about the fact that most people don't realize that wheat was a strategic weapon back in 1972. The Soviet Union, the United States, were trying to negotiate the Strategic Arms Limitations Treaty, the first one, SALT I, back in 72, and the Soviet Union was walking from the table. And they'd had two very bad years of wheat harvest, and there was no wheat, and they needed to feed their people. And what kept the Soviet Union at the table and actually brought that nuclear arms treaty to fruition was wheat from the United States. So wheat was as important as all the guns and bombs and missiles that our Defense Department has always done, has. So I think that wheat's a phenomenal asset to the Great Plains and to our nation. I'm hoping that by this story, we kind of see what the foundation was and the character of the farmers that really kind of now today make it their livelihood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will definitely look forward to getting this published so that others can learn about it, have a chance to see it for themselves too.
Well, we really appreciate it. I can't tell you how much we appreciate it. I know that AgWire is really important for a lot of people, get a lot of their news from that. I can't tell you how many press releases come across my desk from you all, and I know it's important as far as getting information out.
Yeah, well, we do our best for being a small company, and so we appreciate that. Well, thank you very much, Jay Chris, director of the Harvesting the High Plains, a documentary that will be coming out in more widespread distribution this fall, but people can go, we'll remind them again, to harvestingthehighplains.com if they'd like to purchase an initial copy of it now.
If they want their local PBS station to carry it and they haven't seen it there, tell them to call their PBS station, because that will that's really one of the reasons that New Mexico has it. There was an enormous amount of call in New Mexico for people to see the film.
That's a great idea. I'm glad you mentioned that. We will make sure that we get that in there too. So,
and I do also want to say I'm greatly remiss. I have to thank so many people that were involved with the film, and really I do have to thank AGCO and their Gleaner brand. They were a big sponsor of the film, as was the Kansas City Board of Trade and to Bruce Grain and so many others, the foundations that gave. But you know, you can't make a film without partners, and I think these people really saw the benefit of what we were doing in the film. And that was, you know, it's when you do a historical film, you kind of wonder what the current benefit is. And I think that people realize that, you know, what we learn from history, we take with us into the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good point. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I had intended to. So again, thank you very much, Jay. And I've really enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you, Chuck. We appreciate it.